That's the thing. The entire society has to eschew. Don't say it. Now I'll never be able to use that word again without cracking up. The entire society has to eschew material wealth. Do those societies exist? Hard to believe, isn't it? Jenny said. They're all matriarchal, too. You're just saying that to make me feel better, Nora said. It's true, but if it makes you feel better, I don't even care that it's true. Hold on. Without Jenny saying a thing, Nora knew she was opening the refrigerator door to take out the bottle of wine and pour some more into her glass. I'm back, Jenny said. Always. My children are almost exactly the same age I was when I came to New York, Nora said. They're almost exactly the age we were when you and I moved in together. Doesn't that seem like a long time ago?
It does, Jenny said. It seems like a million years ago. And it seems like it was just last week.
Oh, Mrs. Nolan, Mr. Harris just called you, said Nora's assistant, Madison. He'd like you to call him back as soon as you can.
Who?
Nora said, standing in the doorway of her office.
Mr. Harris? He said you knew him.
Did he give you a first name?
Bob,
Madison said. She handed a message slip to Nora.
He said to use this number.
Close the door, Madison, Nora said. Please. Nora looked down at the message slip in front of her, the request to call Bob Harris, founder and chairman of the investment firm where Charlie worked. For just a moment, she had a nonsensical thought, that work was like school, and that just as the head of the middle school had called to tell her that Rachel would suffer an in-school suspension for hiding in the girls' room during an obligatory morning meeting, his boss was calling to give her bad news about Charlie's continued employment. Nora knew this was ridiculous, but she could think of no other reason that Bob Harris, a man who had become legendary for his corn-pone demeanor and uncanny ability to make money, would call her. That was how he was almost always described, the legendary Bob Harris.
Well, hey now,
he said when she dialed the number, which was clearly his private line. No secretary, no intermediary, no screening.
I wonder if you and me could have a little meeting.
About what? Nora said.
See, that's one of the things I always liked about you. You're a straight shooter. None of this, sure, Mr. Harris, when, Mr. Harris, whatever you say, Mr. Harris. About what? That's what I like.
Thank you, Nora said. About what? There was something about Bob Harris that always brought out the peremptory headmistress in her.
I've got a business proposition for you, but I want to have a sit-down to talk more about it. How about if my girl calls your girl and they sync our schedules? What's your girl's name again? She told me, but I don't think I heard her right.
It's Madison.
Well, hell, I did hear her right. What do you know? Tell Madison to call Eileen. I want to get together real soon.
About what? Nora said.
There you go. Like I said, straight shooter. Nothing better. I hate the telephone. Let's get down to brass tacks when I see you.
Nora put down the phone and looked at the clock on her desk. Jenny was in class, teaching, so she couldn't call her. Her sister Christine would be barely awake in Seattle, and she certainly couldn't ask Charlie why Bob Harris would want to speak to her. Nora was completely baffled, but there was no mystery in how her husband would react to a personal call from the man he felt insufficiently valued his talents. Unless he already knew. She had to hope Bob Harris didn't run into Charlie in the elevator anytime soon, that assistant Eileen didn't pass along the word to Charlie's assistant, Marianne, while they were picking up sandwiches for lunch. Nora wondered if Madison had recognized Bob Harris's name. She wouldn't put it past her. Madison had grown up in New York City, and she was as hungry a 24-year-old as Nora had ever encountered. "This is my dream job," she had said during her interview, following up with, "I want to be you when I grow up," which Nora told Jenny made her feel a million years old, and Jenny said would have caused her to shred Madison's resume. Plus, I'm sorry, but how do you take seriously a person who was named after an avenue? Jenny said. You must have had at least one Madison as a student, Nora said.
Of course I have, said Jenny. Right now I have a student named Celestial,
and another named Otto, who insists on spelling his name with a lowercase o at the beginning. But I didn't choose to hire them. They were thrust upon me. Madison was a heat-seeking missile. Nora, by contrast, felt as though she'd fallen into nearly every job she'd had, although Jenny always insisted she was selling herself short. During the summer between sophomore and junior year at Williams, she had wanted to stay on campus because the man with whom she was topsy-turvy in love was working on a historic restoration project nearby. There had been an opening for an assistant in the development office, which was fine with her, although she had had no idea what a development office actually did. 2 weeks in, the assistant director was put on bed rest with a dicey pregnancy, and Nora found herself showing more rich alums around the campus than anyone had expected, and taking several trips to the enormous shingled houses of Nantucket and Narragansett, while the director asked for what Nora quickly learned to call a significant multi-year gift. At the end of the summer, the director had asked her if she would continue part-time during the school year, and when the director left to go to the Folk Art Museum in New York City, she had taken Nora with her. Even before college, Nora had understood that there was a kind of desire expected of smart and capable people that she had never really had, that wanting fever that so clearly ran through Madison's veins. Nora's ambition was a simmer, not a boil. Her best friend in high school had wanted to be an actress with a ferocity that was like a mental illness. It shaped the way Amanda looked at everything. Nora was certain that because of this, she would succeed, that it was this inflammatory ambition, not talent, that made a difference. But in the back of her mind was the understanding that having that kind of hunger was a razor blade hidden at the bottom of the bag, that it meant that not getting what you wanted would be crippling. Nora had to admit that she was slightly relieved not to have it, to be content to move from one responsible position to another in a business that, after all, was all for a good cause. Raising money first for the Folk Art Museum, then for the law school. The Fashion Institute job seemed a bit less like giving back to humanity, but it was the first time she'd been asked to head the office rather than sit second seat, and the money was good. There had been private school tuitions, and the economy had hit one of those speed bumps that made Charlie ask if Rachel really needed to spend the summer at drama camp. The job she had now was some steps up from a development job, and it had literally fallen into her lap. The Fashion Institute had had a lunch to launch its exhibit of a collection of women's clothes of the Jazz Age, the waitstaff weaving carefully among mannequins wearing beaded shifts, fur neck pieces, cloche hats. The Cobb salads and glasses of iced tea were already on the tables when they sat down. "When did the Cobb salad become the official lunch food of New York City women?" said the woman on her left, who had given them a modest gift, although she could have afforded to give them something larger, and who was seated next to Nora so Nora could pry something larger out of her. "And why is a Cobb salad called a Cobb salad?" Nora said. From her other side came a loud nasal voice. "It's named for the owner of the Brown Derby in Hollywood who invented it, out of leftovers." Nora swiveled. "Well, thank you for that," Nora said, in her best development officer voice, trying to read the woman's place card without obviously squinting. She would really have to talk to the staff about making the names larger on the place cards. "And I'm so pleased that you're interested in the Institute. May I call you Bibi?"
"You can call me Queen Elizabeth if you'd like,"
the woman said, pulling the soft center out of the popover on her bread plate.
"I'm not interested in the Fashion Institute. I'm interested in you. I want to offer you a job."
As soon as she got home that evening, she called Christine and told her about the meeting she had had after lunch, which had taken place in the back seat of a Mercedes SUV. "She's insane," Nora said. "She wants to start her own museum, from scratch, and she wants me to run it."
"What kind of museum?"
"Jewelry. She wants to start a museum of jewelry with her own collection, which apparently is pretty large, and the collections of her friends after they die. She says she has two friends who are already willing to kick in." There was a long silence.
"Crazy, right?"
Nora said.
"It's a fantastic idea," Christine said. "It'll be a huge success, Nani. Women will beat down the door.
Nora was the one who was silent this time. Her sister and her husband had started a business in Seattle making yoga clothes with inspirational sayings written in tiny, almost imperceptible letters at the nape of the neck or the edge of the cuff, which Nora had thought was a waste of two good college educations. Each time Nora read a piece about the company, and there were many pieces about the company now, the number of millions it was said to be worth rose. Nora had once made the mistake of saying at a business lunch that her sister was the Christine of small sayings. "Shouting is so over," was their slogan, and she'd had to listen to 15 minutes about the cotton, the fit, the durability, even the sayings, which Nora had once compared to those found in fortune cookies. "I know it sounds silly, but every time I put on that shirt that says today might just be the best day of my life on the hem, I feel good," the director of development at Hunter College had said. "I have that shirt," her assistant had chimed in. "Oh, come on, who's going to beat down the doors to look at jewelry?" Nora said to Christine. "If you want to look at jewelry, you can just walk into Harry Winston." "Ordinary people aren't going to walk into Harry Winston. They made me feel like a shoplifter the one time I was in there. Even Tiffany's makes you feel uncomfortable. But with a museum, you're inviting them in and not even asking them to buy. Although the gift shop opportunities here are major, major. You'll get all those women who want to own some big honking opal, but could never afford it and are thrilled to have a facsimile. Your whole crazy city is aspirational now. People spending more than they can afford, trying to live a big life that's beyond them. This is perfect. It will be huge. I'm telling you." And her sister had been right. Despite condescending comments in the art magazines and a few digs in the newspapers, the Museum of Jewelry took off almost from the day its heavy steel and smoked glass double doors opened. There wasn't much of the sort of work Nora had done before, raising money from people who were constantly being asked to write a check, the ones who were tired of being asked, and the ones who just loved the attention. The museum had a decent endowment. B.B. sold 3 Impressionist oil paintings she said she had always found depressing, and supplemented that with a chunk of her late husband's massive investment portfolio, and they had a large, rather handsome space that B.B. owned outright. Her husband had been a real estate developer who, she said, saw Chelsea as an up-and-coming area before anyone else did. He had built a square, brutalist building close to the river that he intended to market as a mall for galleries. One-stop shopping for the discerning collector. One of the things her husband loved about her, Bibi liked to say, was that she wrote his slogans. But significant galleries were not charmed by the mall idea, and less significant ones couldn't afford the rent. And then Bibi's husband had died. Went, according to Bibi, out like a light in the car on the way home from Le Cirque. Bibi took a tour of the empty building while the estate was being settled and, as she liked to tell reporters, she had a brainstorm while looking down at her cuff bracelet. The museum was born. Bibi's own jewelry had been the bulwark, still was, but over time they had added a collection of black pearls here, a tiara that could be turned into a necklace there, some really spectacular rubies, a group of brooches that had been smuggled out of Tsarist Russia, sewn into somebody's skirt, and so on and so forth. Sitting at her desk now, looking out her office window, Nora couldn't imagine a place that would have less appeal for a man like Bob Harris, who wore a Timex watch that looked as though it had been purchased in a drugstore many years before. They had certainly hosted corporate events at the museum, but they tended to be for cosmetic companies or women's magazines. One of the law firms had had a dinner in one of their galleries, but it was for trust and estate clients, mainly the kind of older women who were most likely to appreciate the museum and perhaps become benefactors. Nora had realized that there was a certain sort of woman in New York who wouldn't think of leaving her jewelry to anyone but her daughters and her granddaughters. But there was another sort, not as many, but enough, who loved the idea of having her name in a display case beneath an emerald parure, a word Nora had not even known until recently. They tended to be much like Bibi, a rich second wife, no children, and no interest in those of her husband. And the law firm had been the one that represented Bibi, which went a long way to explaining why they had had a dinner there. Nora could imagine no possible nexus between Bob Harris and the Museum of Jewelry. Nora had been at the museum from the beginning, when they were choosing staff, fonts, names for the place itself. They decided against Bibi's name since her last name was Pearl.
"People are just dumb enough to think there's nothing but pearls in the place," Bibi said, wearing what would become part of the collection, a huge cuff bracelet inlaid with rubies and a matching brooch shaped like a dragon.
"What was your last name before you were married?" Bibi had once asked Nora, and when Nora told her, she rolled it around in her crimsoned mouth like a piece of hard candy.
"Benson. Nora Benson.
What a nice Protestant American name. But so was your married name. Benson to Nolan. You hardly went anywhere."
The suggestion was that Bibi herself had traveled some distance, and so she had. Her name had once been Edna Wisniewski. She had gone to a high school in Brooklyn famous for graduating nearly every one-hit wonder in the pre-Beatles pop era. On its wall of fame, the two Nobel laureates in medicine were at the far end, back by the boys' bathroom. The first year the museum was open, the school added Bibi to the wall. There was a photograph of a portrait her husband had commissioned right after their marriage. The portrait itself hung inside the museum. It made Bibi look like Elizabeth Taylor, whose jewelry collection she had attempted to emulate. Bibi always dressed in bright Chanel suits with at least two or three stupendous pieces of jewelry, a brooch nestled over her breast, a bracelet that seemed in danger of decommissioning her arm, spectacular earrings. She told Nora that they were copies of the originals, but Nora couldn't tell the difference. Nora never wore any jewelry to work except her wedding ring and a pair of diamond stud earrings. She had scarcely any good stuff, and it seemed somehow improper to wear costume jewelry to the museum. She wore a work uniform, black pants, black shirt in the summer, black sweater in the winter, black jacket, black wool coat, black suit jacket, all of it good fabric and cuts. When she had a business lunch, she wore a black skirt.
"Someday, babe," Jenny had said once, "you are going to cut loose and wear navy blue."
Bibi approved. She had decided that Nora had made a conscious decision to fade into the background of the museum, not that Nora was accustomed to fading into the background wherever she went. Nora's concession to variety and color was a scarf. She had dozens, maybe hundreds, of scarves. It had made her birthday and Christmas easy for Charlie, who was the kind of terrible gift giver who, when they were first married, had given her craft show jewelry made of papier-mâché and small appliances that had limited use. Bibi always referred to Nora's scarves as schmatas, which was as close as she ever came to acknowledging her origins as a fit model in a low-end sports warehouse, whose showroom, ironically, had been just a few blocks from the museum.
"Do you know Bob Harris?" Nora asked when she passed Bibi's office on the day that Bob called her.
"That super rich guy? I don't think I've ever met him. Don't get me wrong, I'd love to, but I'm pretty sure I would remember if I had."
"Why?"
"Just wondering," Nora said.
"Here's what I keep wondering about, Cookie," Bibi said. "How come we can't get rid of that hobo outside?"
"Hobo? Now there's a word I haven't heard in a long time.
Why can't we get someone to move him along?
The Constitution? The right of the people to assemble? Free speech? Sidewalk?"
Bibi made a sound of dismissal and disapproval, not unlike the ones charity sometimes favored. The man who sat on the sidewalk near the museum entrance said his name was Phil, but who knew? When Nora had contacted the city about him after the museum first opened, when he was out on the street with a lugubrious mutt of some indeterminate kind, she'd been handed from office to office until finally she gave up and called the local church shelter and got someone smart, with a sense of humor, who recognized the sign he had then, which read, "Please help with dog food. He's hungry."
"Not to worry," the woman said with a throaty chuckle. "He's not really what we classify as homeless. Call the ASPCA about the dog. They'll make him leave at home."
Nora had had one of their security people work overtime to keep an eye out. As it turned out, Phil picked up his blanket, his sign, and his dog as darkness began to fall and took everything to a battered Subaru Outback parked in a spot reserved for vehicles with commercial plates, which the car actually had.
The security guy had friends who were cops, and one of them did a computer search and found out the Outback was registered to a P.G. Moines, who lived in a two-family house in Queens that had been carved up into apartments. "You are a complete fraud," Nora said the following week when Phil appeared in his usual spot. Phil laughed.
"You too,"
he said. His sign now read, "A sandwich is only $3. Two women stopped and dropped a dollar bill into his big red cup. Phil put his fingers to his lips as the women moved away.
"If you don't tell on me, I won't tell on you," he said. "How's the jewelry biz?"
"It's a museum," Nora said.
"Tomato, tomato,"
Phil said.
"I hope you're happy now. My poor dog is cooped up in the house all day instead of getting fresh air."
"Where can you get a sandwich for only $3? Nora said.
"You need to relax more," said Phil. "You're too literal-minded."
"That's what my daughter says," Nora said.
"Smart girl,"
said Phil. It is necessary to raise the monthly charge for parking from $325 to $350. Please remit on November 1 accordingly. Sincerely, Sydney Stoller. As the weather grew colder and the days shorter, as Nora moved the sweaters from basement closets to bedroom bureaus, the atmosphere on the block seemed to darken. One evening, taking Homer out for the last walk, she had stumbled on something on her front steps, and, as she righted herself, Homer stepped forward gingerly to sniff at a small bag with a knot at the top. Someone had left discarded dog poop on her stoop. With two fingers, Nora put it in the trash can. She looked up and down the street, but there was no one in sight. "Yuck," she said aloud, and Homer looked up solemnly. It had also begun to feel as though the parking lot was more of a curse than a blessing, as though the men on the block had sold their souls to some devil of convenience.
"We let Nolan in and everything went to hell,"
George said jovially one morning. It was another reason Nora couldn't bear him. There was no one like George for saying something lacerating in a hail fellow voice. First, the Lessmans had come out to find the windshield of their car shattered. There was a good deal of speculation about what had happened, although George had immediately said,
"Let's not fool ourselves, folks,"
and gestured toward the windows of the SRO. Linda Lessman said that their insurance company had refused to pay until the adjuster had determined whether it was a spontaneous event.
"Like spontaneous combustion?" Linda said, her fists on her narrow hips. "Are there numerous instances of windshields just shattering into a thousand pieces?"
After that, there was the junker of a car with stickers for Carlsbad Caverns, the Sierra Club, and Ralph Nader that had been abandoned in front of the curb cut leading into the lot, so that all the cars within were trapped and effectively held hostage. That was bad enough, but Jack Fisk, who had once had what he habitually called juice with city government, now no longer seemed to wield the same power. When the junker had first appeared, Jack had snapped his fingers at the others as he stood in his blue chalk-striped suit on the sidewalk. "Gone. Like that," he'd promised. But it wasn't until 3 days later that a tow truck had snagged the car's dinged front bumper with the hook.
"I hate working this block,"
the tow operator said to Nora as Homer sniffed at his front tire and then lifted his leg in a casual arabesque.
"It's a nightmare getting in and out of here." "It's about goddamn time,"
Jack Fisk had shouted when he saw that the junker was gone. Sherry had told Nora that Jack's firm had a mandatory retirement age of 65. After that, your name moved from the equity partner column on the left of the letterhead to a column on the right for what were called senior counselors, but were understood to be over-the-hill guys. "They call it the obituary column," Sherry said.
"Yikes,"
Nora said. It was early on a Sunday, just past 9, and Nora was still in her running clothes. Sherry was carrying a bag of bagels. "Oh, it gets worse. Guess who dreamed up the idea for mandatory retirement when he was a young Turk?" Sherry nodded down the block toward her husband's back. "Yikes," Nora repeated. There wasn't even anyone to complain to about the problems with the parking lot. It was owned by a ghost, a man none of them had ever actually met. Sydney Stoller, that was how they made out their checks, sent to a post office box and due the first of the month. Every time she ran into an old man on the block, Nora imagined it might be Sydney Stoller, finally come to call. But as far as she knew, it never was. "Please, can we go back to the old garage?" Nora had said the week before, as she and Charlie read the inside sections of the Sunday New York Times, the ones that were printed early.
"Why? Because the lot is $25 more now? I know you weren't a math major, but even you can figure out that that's still a net savings."
Nora lowered the book review. "There's no need to get nasty," she said. "The parking situation on the block is causing a lot of bad feeling, not to mention that now all of you are being ordered around by that idiot George."
"What is it Rachel always says about you? You're so judgy. All I know is I've got a lunch in 2 hours in Stanford,"
said Charlie, pushing back his chair and not looking at her.
"And if Ricky has me blocked in, there's going to be more than bad feeling."
"It's Saturday, Charlie. Ricky doesn't work on Saturdays." But of course that wasn't true. Ricky worked whenever anyone needed him. Sherry Fisk had once called him at home on a Sunday night when a pipe in her basement was spewing water all over the floor, and a half hour later he was downstairs, his toolbox and a shop vac on the steps, taking care of business. Obviously, Jack Fisk had forgotten all about that. He'd come out one morning to take his car from the lot and found Ricky's van blocking him in, or at least that's what he said. It was only a day after the junker had finally been towed, and Jack was still in a bit of a rage, which was more or less his natural condition. When he finally tracked Ricky down at the Rizzoli's, where he was fixing a garbage disposal in which a teaspoon was thoroughly jammed, Ricky tried to argue that Jack had room to get around his van, which made Jack only angrier.
"Don't tell me I can get around you,"
Jack screamed while Ricky stood with rounded shoulders on the stoop.
"It's not my goddamn job to get around you. It's your job to stay out of my goddamn way."
Sherry had apologized to Nora for her husband. Predictably, of our two sons, one has a volcanic temper and the other is so conflict avoidant that if you ran him over with a tank, he'd say, "Oh, sorry, I was in your way," she said sadly. Andrew and his wife want to have kids, and I suggested before they do, he try anger management classes.
"What did he say?"
Nora asked. "What always happens when you suggest a man take anger management classes?"
"He gets angry?"
"See? And you're not even a therapist," said Sherry, who was. Linda Lessman, who always saw the world in black and white, which Nora imagined must be a useful quality in a criminal court judge, unless you were a defendant, had once said she didn't understand why anyone who was a therapist would put up with a man like Jack. But Nora had always tended to see most things in shades of gray, and she had noticed that logic and marital relations often seemed at odds with each other. Nora also understood the genesis of Jack's immediate rage. In her experience, nothing made a man angrier than being told that he couldn't drive like NASCAR. She remembered one terrible day when Charlie had been trying to get the car into a tiny street space on the way to an open house for a co-op apartment. It had taken so long that Oliver, whose toilet training was a bit dicey well into kindergarten, had wet his pants. When Charlie zoomed away because the space was far too small, Nora had been sure that if you'd used a tape measure, you would have discovered their car was a good foot longer than the space was. Rachel had made the mistake of saying, "Aren't you going to try again, Daddy?" That had been one to remember. And so it went on the block, mishap by misadventure. After the broken windshield, the junker, and Jack's tantrum, a transformer blew in a Con Edison grate and the entrance to the lot was temporarily blocked while it was repaired. Charlie, Jack, George, Harold Lessman, the oldest Rizzoli son, and two of the guys who lived in the SRO were standing that Sunday morning at the edge of the hole the utility workers had made. Nora had stopped to look into it when she was out with Homer. The improbable guts of New York lay exposed below her in the kind of filthy trench she imagined you could find anywhere from Lexington Avenue to Wall Street. Peering into the hole made by the Con Ed guys, Nora thought it was amazing that anything held together at all. That water came out of their taps, that power went into their outlets, that their houses didn't all tumble to the ground. The dirty little secret of the city was that while it was being constantly created, glittering glass and steel towers rising everywhere where once there had been parking lots, gas stations, and four-story tenements, it was simultaneously falling apart. The streets were filled with excavations and repair crews, the older buildings sheathed in scaffolding cages.
Scaffolding, Charlie had muttered one day not long ago. That's the business I should have gone into. If I owned a scaffolding firm, I'd be a rich man today. A lot of salt damage,
she heard the older of the SRO guys say now, as the men clustered around the hole. Despite what they had all believed when they moved onto the block, most of the SRO guys worked, the kind of journeyman jobs that once used to allow for a small apartment in Hell's Kitchen, and now only provided for a room with a hot plate in a single-room occupancy hotel. Rumor had it that Sidney Stoller owned the SRO, too, but no one had ever been able to determine if that was true. There was no point in looking at the deed. There would surely be some corporate title obscuring the name of the true owner. All real estate in Manhattan now seemed to change hands under the cover of an LLC. No millionaire ever sold his duplex on East End Avenue to another millionaire. It was always Blair Holdings LLC to Sadieland LLC or such like, the names of children being popular covers for the true identities of their parents. Down the block, the men were squatting at the edge of the hole, desk guys pretending they knew what it took to work with their hands. Nora remembered how contemptuous she had once been of couples who drove in the car with the two men in the front and the two women in the back. The men and women on the block now did the same when they got together to talk. The women were talking about people, the men talking about things. It was why so many of the men prospered on Wall Street and in the big law firms, where things could be turned into money and people were interchangeable and even insignificant, and there were hardly any women running the show. The night before, she and Charlie had gone to have dinner with Jenny and the man with whom she was currently sleeping, and Nora and Jenny had decided that they were giving boy-girl seating up because Charlie and Jasper spent the entire evening talking to each other, and Nora and Jenny the same, which was fine with everyone involved. "What does Jasper do?" Nora had asked Jenny in the kitchen. "He's a cabinet maker, and also a voiceover actor and a dialect coach. Promise me he's not also a mime. Anything but a mime." Jenny put cheese and grapes on a platter. "Would I sleep with a mime?" she said. "You slept with that circus clown." "That was a long time ago, and I was really drunk." In the car on the way home, Nora said to Charlie, "You seem to get on with him."
"He's a smart guy," Charlie said. "He's kind of wasted making kitchen cabinets, but hey, who am I to talk? Jenny'll have a nice kitchen, and he'll get whatever. I wonder if he charges less if you're sleeping with him while he's doing your kitchen."
"Wait, I knew she was redoing her kitchen, but I didn't know the guy she was dating was the contractor."
"She's your best friend. How come you don't already know this? And is dating a term that ever applies to Jenny?"
Charlie had always found Jenny's promiscuity threatening. As though were a communicable disease, as though Nora were going to have breakfast with Jenny and then give a man she met in the coffee shop line a blowjob in the restroom. "My best friend is seeing the man who is redoing her kitchen," Nora said to Sherry Fisk now, not meaning to say it aloud until she'd already done so. "Seeing, sleeping with, what do we call it now?"
"I bet it will be a great kitchen," Sherry said.
"You have to do something to make a kitchen renovation bearable," said Alma Fenstermacher, who had stopped to join them. She stared for a moment at the scrum at the end of the street, then walked on, perhaps, Nora thought, to attend church. Alma seemed like the sort of person to attend church on Sunday.
"Why do I like her?" Sherry said. "I shouldn't like her. She's so
perfect," Nora said. "You can always tell her closets are always tidy. See? Tidy. That's a word I've probably never used before to describe anyone, but it's perfect for Alma. She's a throwback to another era, before we wore workout clothes all the time and used profanity. She's perfect, and yet she's perfectly nice. It's impossible not to like her." The Con Ed truck rumbled down the street, and the men at the lot entrance began to disperse.
"I have to tell you, I'm grateful for this," Sherry said, gesturing down the street. At least it gives my husband something else to obsess about. This whole thing with the parking lot is a metaphor for his entire life right now. These guys have no life except for their jobs. So without their jobs, they have no life. Jack gets out of bed mad and goes to bed mad. I think he's mad in his dreams. Yikes, said Nora again, but she couldn't help nodding. Nora thought Charlie's dissatisfaction with his work, and therefore his life, had begun to grow with his 50th birthday 2 years before. She had hosted a dinner for 20 at an expensive restaurant they both liked, but her husband had so much to drink that he started to sob during Oliver's toast. And it wasn't even that good, Rachel said the next day, and fell asleep with his mouth open in the back of the car on the way home. Charlie was an investment banker. It had become enough to say that, at parties, in conversation. No one really knew what that meant except other finance guys, and they liked the fact that they spoke a secret language that others, especially women, couldn't understand. Nora had made it her business to listen carefully to the long, discursive stories he told at dinner about deals, firms, personalities, possibilities, but it was all too boring. At a certain point, simply pretending to listen, looking attentive, nodding, and umming from time to time, seemed like enough of a sacrifice. So Charlie would say, "You're not going to believe this one," and Nora would go elsewhere in her mind. Replacement of the living room drapes, bong in Oliver's bedroom drawer, press for the upcoming exhibit. She'd gotten good at it. Charlie would say in the dark at night, "Remember that deal I told you Jim and I were working on?" And Nora would say, "Yes, of course," and start umming again, and he'd be content. Rachel had begged Charlie to be one of the parents at career day at her school when she was in third grade, one of the phases of Oedipal transference in which she thought her father was handsome and brilliant and her mother was nobody and had stupid hair. The two of them had come home at the end of the day, each wearing the expression of someone sorely disappointed. "Apparently, I'm a bad explainer," Charlie said, filling a glass with ice cubes and vodka and yanking Rachel's favorite pink patterned tie, the one with wolves in sheep's clothing, through the lariat of his collar. Rachel had already started upstairs to her bedroom. "A horrible explainer," she yelled before slamming the door. "Even I can't really explain what Daddy does," Nora said later when she was tucking her in. But Rachel said, turning to the wall, "Then he shouldn't have come to school to talk about it." Increasingly, what Charlie talked about was what he called the short pants boys, by which he meant the young associates, some of whom prospered to what Charlie insisted was a laughable degree by means ranging from nepotism to ass-kissing to dirty dealing. Charlie had once been one of those young men, and while he had done his share of ass-kissing, he had at first prospered because he shone with simple decency, which was still the case and owed more to fair hair and skin than anyone ever realized. Over the years, his colleagues had waited for the shark to emerge from behind the nice guy, the wolf in sheep's clothing, to make an appearance, the open-faced mask to drop. Nora suspected that when they realized it was not a mask at all, they had begun to value Charlie less. She never mentioned those early years when, as he liked to say, the sky was the limit. Nor did she intend to mention that the legendary Bob Harris had been so very anxious to meet with her. When she had finally agreed to sit down with him, she had insisted on meeting on an evening when she knew her husband had a client dinner across town. When Nora arrived at the office, she slunk onto the executive floor as though she were there for an assignation, and indeed, Bob Harris had attempted to corner her in the past at least two office functions.
"Can't blame a guy for trying now, can you?" he'd said.
Unlike many of the New York transplants Nora met, Bob Harris did not pretend to be the manner born, but instead went the opposite way, milked his origins preposterously. He twanged like a banjo, called soda pop, and liked to say things like, "When pigs fly." His firm was called Parsons Ridge, after the town in West Virginia where he'd been born. "That sounds picturesque," the PR assistant wife of one of the short pants boys had said at a cocktail party.
"It's a shithole," Harris had said. "You look fine," he said now, Nora sitting opposite him in his office.
"And you, Mr. Harris?" He sighed, reached for his bourbon.
He always took it with a maraschino cherry for some reason, and Nora had noticed that the level in his glass stayed more or less the same through any event or evening. Nora had passed on a drink. She'd worn a black fluted skirt not conducive to giving the person sitting opposite a peek at her panties. Some of the men she had to do business with would drop their pens so their eyes were level with her knees and any gap between them. Bob wouldn't see the point of that.
"No matter what I do, you're never going to call me Bob," he said, "even if I get you to come work for me."
"Hard to figure out how that would happen," Nora said, "since I know next to nothing about your business." She'd noticed that when people were around Bob Harris, they tended to lapse into his syntax and vocabulary. She'd once heard a partner who had attended prep school and Yale unthinkingly use the verb reckon, as in Bob saying,
"I don't reckon it's much of a secret that I'm putting a pile of money into a foundation. A pile of money."
"How much is a pile?" Nora asked.
"You are a pisser,"
Bob Harris said, shaking his head.
"Anybody else sits there all quiet and mealy-mouthed. Butter would melt in it. Thinking what you're thinking but not saying it. For now, let's keep the exact number on the QT. Let's just say it will make all these folks sit up and take notice. What do you think about education?"
"Do you care about education?"
"Hell, woman, everybody cares about education. Not that I did much with mine, just..."
He chuckled and gestured to the enormous plate glass window as though it were a trophy case, assorted skyscrapers just beyond the sill. Bob Harris liked to make much of the fact that he had gone to a third-tier state school and gotten thrown out for making a chain of women's undergarments that stretched around the entire administration building. Twice.
"In every color under the sun, boys. Not just your white ones, either. A lot of black and red. A lot."
He had a mysterious wife whom various profiles said he'd married while he was still in school, who was never seen, and was said to live nearly all the time at their farm, which was in Virginia. There were no photographs of her in his office, nor of their son, who was said to be a geologist in New Mexico. Nora refused to fill the silence.
"So what about it?"
Bob continued.
"Come run this foundation for me. People I know think you're good at what you do. You gotta have better things to do than shepherd a lot of housewives around looking at bracelets."
"It's a museum. We offer historical and educational programs."
"There you go. You're already in the education business. You got no learning curve. And a nice manner."
He leaned forward, and Nora pressed her knees together and smoothed her skirt. She thought surreptitiously, until he grinned.
"You know why you're really here? One time I asked you about that museum, which I have to say I don't get the point of one bit, and you said to me, 'All jobs sound silly, unless you're a pediatric oncologist or a plumber.' You remember saying that?"
Nora shook her head, although it was certainly possible. Somehow she always found herself more outspoken with Bob Harris than she was with almost anyone else. "I'd need to know a lot more about how you plan to proceed to even think about this, Mr. Harris. The regulations governing foundations are pretty stringent, and the foundations that do good work do it because they're focused, certain of their mission, with a clear sense of where and how to spend their money." Bob Harris waved his hand in the air, picked up his bourbon glass, looked at it as though he were admiring the brown velvet color, which Nora had to admit was pretty, put it down again. She couldn't help herself. She said, "Do you ever actually drink one of those?" Bob Harris raised the glass to her.
"Smart. Smart girl. Excuse me, woman. Smart woman. That'd be good, too. Have the foundation run by a woman. Whatever needs to be done, we'll do it. Whatever you need, we'll get it for you. Just have a little think on it, all right? Just a little think."
On her way out, Nora turned and said, "May I ask a small favor?"
"God bless you, girl. I love the way you put words together."
Nora couldn't help herself. She started to laugh. "Oh, can the hayseed act, Bob?" she said. To her surprise and admiration, he started to laugh as well.
"What's the favor?"
he said in an almost accentless voice, as though he were an actor who had heard the director cry, "Cut," and had gone back to his everyday way of talking. "I already think one problem with your plan is the nepotism issue," she said. "My husband works for you, so in the meantime, would you not mention to him that we've discussed this?" Bob Harris shrugged.
"Darling, I mentioned to him just this morning that we had a little meeting scheduled. Swear on my mama. I was amazed that he didn't seem to know anything about it.
And before her opened a vista of the evening and probably the week to come. Silent treatment, recriminations, questions, recriminations, silent treatment. Which was precisely the way it went. Charlie at the dining room table with the drink and the greasy paper plate that meant he'd picked up a slice of pizza instead of heating up something Charity had left in the refrigerator. The bottle of vodka was on the table, too. That was the signal that Charlie Nolan was headed for blind drunk when the bottle was on the table. Drunk as hell. Nora had stepped out of her heels in the foyer and walked barefoot into the kitchen, wondering how far down that road he'd traveled.
I thought you had a business dinner, she said.
Canceled, he said. When were you going to mention your meeting with Bob Harris?
It just happened, Nora said, pouring some white wine and reaching for a container of leftover Chinese. So I was going to tell you about it once I got home, and now I'm home.
So you're going to go work for him,
said Charlie, declaratively, savagely. No, I'm not, Nora said. He doesn't have a clear plan, and I already have a good job.
He won't like that. He doesn't like people who say no to him.
Nora sat down and looked at Charlie. She was thinking that Bob Harris struck her as exactly the kind of man who liked people who said no to him. Instead, she said, too bad for him.
You don't even know him,
Charlie said. The word don't was a shapeless, slippery thing in the very back of his throat, and Nora knew that Charlie had gone way down the vodka road before she'd arrived. I've met him many times at your events.
Did he say why he came to you in the first place?
Charlie said. And while Nora had asked herself the same question, she shot back, that's insulting.
Come on, Nora. If you're as big as Bob Harris and you're starting a foundation, there are 100 people you could pick to run it.
I repeat, that's insulting. I'm insulted. Maybe you want to stop insulting me now. Homer put his head in Nora's lap and whined. Did you walk him? She asked. Of course not. Come on, good boy.
At least one of us is a winner with that asshole,
Charlie said as he stumbled upstairs and Nora went down to the foyer.
Kiss my ass,
she thought she heard as she snapped on Homer's leash. His boss? His wife? The universe? Who could tell? On the stoop sat another tightly knotted plastic bag. What next? Nora asked loudly. I mean, really, what next? There was no way Nora would speak to Charity about any of this, about the parking situation or the bags on the stoop or Charlie's black moods. It was important that Charity be kept as contented as possible, or as contented as Charity ever got, which was not so much when the twins were not around. The Monday after Thanksgiving, she came up from the basement, where she always changed into her work clothes, sweatpants, and a t-shirt, and said to Nora dolefully, "My baby's back at college now." Rachel and Oliver had arrived toting enormous duffels filled with dirty clothes, knowing Charity would be happy to see and launder and iron them, even the boxer shorts. Charity had done just that, repacked them, and sent them back to school refreshed, as she always did. She was habitually downcast after the hubbub was over. Charity had always been their nanny, arriving at their apartment only an hour after they had gotten home from the hospital, making clucking noises as the two handfuls of swaddle, one dark, the other fair, squirmed and whined.
Peace, peace, peace,
Charity had whispered, and Nora was all in. Aside from the fact that Charity passionately believed Nora needed to drink Guinness in order to breastfeed successfully, and was sure that the twins were starving and so tried to sneak them bottles of formula larded with rice cereal, she had been a very satisfactory nanny. She was always on time, she never refused to stay late, and she adored the twins without indulging them. She taught Ollie the rules of cricket, arranged Rachel's unruly hair, had muffins on the counter after school when they were young, and then fruit juices when they both started playing after-school sports. There was no hint of equivocation or dispassion in her devotion. You couldn't mention the word Harvard around Charity because Rachel had been denied admission, and Nora suspected she had found and destroyed all photographs of the girl who had broken up with Oliver senior year of high school. Nora had only had to have a sit-down with Charity once, years before, when Charity had decided to let the kids know what a friend they had in Jesus. Charlie was a lapsed Catholic. Nora had grown up vaguely Presbyterian. But Charity belonged to the Church of the Living Risen Son of God, a mainly Jamaican congregation, which met in what had formerly been a movie theater. Nora knew this because Rachel had given her a full report after Charity had agreed to stay for a weekend when Nora and Charlie were obliged to go on one of those 3-day golf and spa trips that a director Charlie worked with considered essential for team building. The blood of the lamb seemed to have figured prominently in the service, as did the notion that everyone was a poor sinner.
"I need to be cleansed in the waters, Mommy," Rachel said, "in the River Jordan."
When Nora confronted Charity about this, she seemed not the least contrite.
"Children be needing the Lord in their lives," Charity said.
"I know you believe that," Nora said, "but Charlie and I have different ideas about religion."
"Some things are just believing," Charity had said, lifting her chin. "Some things, just the truth."
"Guess that shut you right up," Christine had said on the phone. Charity was the source of most intelligence about the block, which she got from the other housekeepers and nannies. As they walked the dogs and swept the sidewalks, they gossiped about movie stars, popular singers, and the people they worked for. 3 months before the Levinsons put their house on the market, 2 months before Dory Levinson had given her husband's clothes, tennis rackets, and chess set to a charity shop and had the locks changed while he was at work. Charity had said,
"Mr. and Mrs. Levinson no good."
Nora had been able to call Alma Finstermacher and bring over a tin of cookies in a timely fashion because Charity said,
"Mr. Finstermacher, no more bladder."
It was Edward Finstermacher's gallbladder, of course. Not his bladder, but Nora had still been glad of the intelligence. It was important not to cross Charity unnecessarily. Early on, Nora had said jocularly, having heard an exchange on the playground between two nannies, "Do all Caribbean women yell at each other all the time?"
"What?"
Charity had shouted, and Nora just shut up. She had had to clear Ricky with Charity before he started working in the house.
"Puerto Rico,"
Charity had said, adding a sound like air going out of a tire under pressure. It had taken 2 years of his meticulous service for her to acknowledge that Ricky was not lazy and to stop checking Nora's jewelry box for theft after he left, although how could he possibly steal anything when Charity hung over his shoulder like a shawl, Nora could not imagine. Charity eventually acknowledged that he was hardworking and trustworthy, but said this was because he was actually from South America, which was not true, although he was not Puerto Rican either. She had also let Nora know when Ricky and his wife had had first one child, then another. Nora had passed clothes and sports equipment that had once belonged to the twins along to Ricky's boys, who were now 8 and 10 and whose photographs posed in front of a spectacularly phony mountain backdrop were taped to the dash of the van. There was a shadow government on the block. A shadow government that knew where all the bodies were buried. A system of mutual dependence, one group needing services, the other employment. Nora was never certain where the balance of power fell. Charity knew when Nora bought new underpants. When Rachel was menstruating, she changed the sheets so she knew when Nora and Charlie had had sex, which was not so often now. She picked up their prescriptions. She knew their secrets. Nora would never forget the two of them sitting side by side on the couch in the den of their old apartment, staring at the television screen the September morning of the terrorist attacks downtown. The sound the two of them made together as the first of the World Trade Center towers disintegrated in slow motion. That day was the first time she had ever seen Charity sit down while at work. It was the first time Charity had stayed overnight when Nora and Charlie were there as well. At dawn, Nora had found her in the kitchen, listening to the radio, making sandwiches for the firefighters at the fire station nearby. Charity, wiping the tears from her face with the back of the hand that held the bread knife. Wordlessly, Nora had joined her. The only other time Nora had seen Charity weep was at the twins' high school graduation. She had worn a pink hat with silk flowers and a pink suit. Oliver had gone out and gotten Charity an orchid corsage. Nora would bet anything that the corsage was pressed somewhere, perhaps in the pages of Charity's Bible. When Nora passed Ricky Monday morning, she called, "Good morning, Enrique," in as cheery a voice as possible, given the atmosphere around the parking lot.
"You need me, Mrs. Nolan?"
Ricky said. "Charity says the dryer isn't working properly."
"That vent," Ricky said, shaking his head. "I'll take care of it. We don't want to get on Charity's bad side."
"No, we do not," Nora said. Linda Lessman was waiting for a cab on the corner to go to work at the criminal courts building. Her fair hair was always damp in the mornings since, having been the captain of her college swimming team, with the square shoulders and narrow hips to prove it, she tried to do laps each day before work. Nora had been a little afraid of her when the Nolans first arrived on the block, of Linda's blunt, declarative sentences and direct gaze, but over time, she had come to like her. Legend had it that residents of the block had once caught up with one another in the supermarket and the drugstore, but the supermarket had been replaced by a 20-story condo building, the drugstore by a bank branch, and everything was delivered now, the groceries, the dry cleaning, the takeout. When the twins were home, they had breakfast delivered, coffee in go-cups and pancakes in foam containers. At 2 a.m., they would often order tikka masala and cheese fries, sushi, and baklava.
"You ladies seen Ricky?"
George called from halfway down the block. Linda and Nora both stared at him as he approached. He was wearing what appeared to be a baby carrier, the kind of front pack in which Nora and Charlie had once carried the twins, switching their respective burdens back and forth because carrying Oliver was like carrying a sack of flour and carrying Rachel was like carrying a bag of ferrets. In the baby carrier was George's newest rescue pug, who stared balefully at Nora with its bug eyes. Nora thought all pugs looked baleful.
"She's got an issue with anxiety," George said, looking down at the dog. "The vet thought this might help."
"Really?" said Linda. One word, and Linda could effortlessly communicate skepticism and contempt. She must be hell on feckless lawyers. "If George upsets Ricky, I will snatch him bald-headed," Linda muttered as he walked away. "That is an expression I haven't heard in years.
I've always thought it was a good one. I wish there was a way I could use it in court," Linda said,
a cab pulling up next to her. "Cher?"
"I'm walking," Nora said.
Nora walked to work nearly every morning, and had for years. People always acted as though it had to do with staying fit, but the fact was she found it an almost spiritual exercise. When Nora was 9, her mother had brought her in on the train for lunch and the Christmas show at Radio City. They had stepped out of Grand Central onto the street, and Nora had turned to look up at the facade, and the statue of Mercury, perched at the center of the roofline, seemed to be looking back toward her. When they got home, her mother had slipped off her black pumps in the living room, an angry red line encircling her narrow insteps, and breathed, "I am exhausted," before she went upstairs. Nora had never felt more alive in her life. She'd never been entirely sure of what to do with herself. She'd had a poem in the high school literary magazine, but then she had submitted 2 short stories in the poem to a legendary seminar at college and gotten them back with N.A. on the front. Not accepted. Not good enough. She had taken a prep course for the law boards, but her mind kept wandering. And she felt as though graduate school would take forever. The one thing she had always been certain of was that she wanted to move to New York after college. And she had. That had been a different New York, different from the one she had visited that first time with her mother. Nearly all of the people on the block had come to the city just as it was digging itself out of a deep hole of insolvency and crime. Yet they had wanted desperately to come there nonetheless, despite the need to hold keys thrust between their fingers as makeshift weapons, the need to have a blood test after a night of so-so sex. Then, slowly, over the last 2 decades, New York had become safe, cleaner, and then impossible for anyone who didn't have a lot of money.
Times Square, once a tattered circus sideshow of women in hot pants and plastic heels selling themselves cheap, of hunched, half-crazy homeless guys pushing leaflets for peep shows, of all-hours coffee shops that served pancakes to junkies at 3 in the morning, was now a fever dream of neon and virtual reality billboards so thick with tourists that New Yorkers avoided it at all costs. The city had become